with that, I give you Phil.
Hey, everybody. My name is Phil Spohr. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Phil. We love you, Phil. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Bunches!
You know, when you're the recipient of that, it's much better. You know? Seems kind of weird until then. Thank you very much. Sobriety Day is August 2nd, 1986. I share that, not to give me credit, but to give credit to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no way. I shared last night, I'm basically a schmuck, and if I can do it, anybody can. So good to be here this morning, good to be sober. Thank you, Ashley. I love Ashley. One of the things I love about Ashley, I heard her at Free Legacy just recently, and at that meeting, Ashley talks faster than I do. And believe me, I talk pretty fast, so I was impressed with that. That being said, I do talk fast, and what I'll share this morning, by the way, diehards are here, thanks for being here, I appreciate that. I do talk fast, and either listen fast or take a nap. If you take the steps to your sponsor, you'll get the same results. It ain't going to matter, I promise. So this is just a talk. So I guess I'll start off, I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope, what I was like, what happened to what I'm like today. I don't share what it was like, it hasn't changed, but I'll try to show what I was like. I grew up about 85 miles northwest of here. I'm a farm hick. Grew up on a farm, corn and beans, a lot of hogs, quite a few cattle. And I guess what that gave me, I did grow up with a work ethic. My dad would have had no other way. My dad was kind of a tough guy. I won't say the word hard, but he was kind of a tough guy. And we grew up knowing how to work. I grew up close to a town. Anybody in here drinkers or like to drink? Anybody like to drink? Okay. Anybody whiskey drinkers? Whiskey. Okay, so maybe you've heard of this. I grew up near a town called Templeton. It's famous for a rye whiskey called Templeton Rye. And when I was a kid, it wasn't bottled yet. They did the moonshine stuff, and it was like 190 proof. And man, I'll tell you what, yeah, that was the stuff. And I share this a lot in my story. Later on, I loved 100 proof vodka, but you take three long pulls of that stuff and exhale, and everything was better. Anybody relate to that feeling? Yeah, I love that feeling. Live for that feeling. So I grew up there on that farm, and I was always a little guy. I graduated high school 115 pounds, so you can imagine. I was a little guy. Got good grades. I went to a little grade school close to home, 20 kids in my grade, and I graduated grade school. Graduated, whatever, we didn't have graduations back then. Nowadays, my grandkids do. Got out of there and went down to a bigger school about 13 miles away. And it wasn't big, but it was big for me. And about that same period of time, I like to share. I grew up going to church. I did go to church every Sunday morning growing up, and I heard things in church. And I always preface this: I am a very literal kid, always was, and I heard things in church that made me believe I was probably going to burn in hell. Okay, I was 11 years old, doing things little boys do at 11 years old, and I knew I was going to burn in hell, and I was scared. I was extremely fearful. I used to not be able, and I'm telling the truth here. I couldn't sleep at night a lot of times. And I go down and tell my dad, who already mentioned is kind of a tough guy, and he said, get your ass back upstairs and count sheep or something, lay there. And I couldn't go to sleep because I was afraid I was going to die in my sleep and go to hell. So that was where I was at. So that at that same period, same kind of age period, I went down to this bigger school, and I was the geek. I was the geek in school, okay? I got good grades. I was a little guy, like I said. I had this horrible colic. Now I part it there, but I had this horrible colic, and I would comb my hair in the morning, comb my hair, and the colic would still stick out. And I ended up getting these glasses that were wire rim, dark glasses, and they looked just goofy. And they picked on my glasses. Then I got contacts because I didn't like my glasses anymore, and I'd blink all the time. They'd call me Blinky, so I couldn't hit a lick. Was the bottom line. I know I just hated it. I couldn't hit a lick. And the miracle, absolute miracle, that happened for me. Between my 8th and 9th grade years, I was young for my grades, so I was 13 years old. I was at a graduation party for an older kid, and they had keg beer. Now, I had been around drinking. My parents had these big card parties. My dad was a pretty big farmer in the area, so they'd have farmers come over, and we had card parties, and I was around drinking all the time. And my parents, never saw my parents drunk once, never did. But I wasn't scared of drinking, but I just never done it. And this kid offered me a keg beer, and I took a glass, and I drank it. And then I was probably, 70 pounds. And I drank six beers that night, six glasses of beer. And yeah, that thing we talked about, is like, holy cow, everything changed that night. I'm not kidding you. I got bigger. I could talk to the guys. much more important than I talk to the girls. And I absolutely love that stuff. And I remember riding home with my little brother and sister in the back of the Family Caprice Classic and leaning over to her and saying, I think I'm drunk. And she looked at me like I was stupid. I'm like, man, you don't understand. This is the best stuff in the world. And so I made a decision. And again, I grew up on a farm, like I said. So my parents had booze. I was really scared of my dad, but I would steal it when I could. I would put, you know, water. You heard it all, water in the vodka, or I'd take a little bit of Jim Beam. They had a lot of cream de menthe. Everybody had cream de menthe. They make grasshoppers. I was thick and green. Oh. I had friends over one time, and we had a camp when I was a kid, and we camped out in my camper in the backyard. And I was probably 14, I suppose. And they came over, and we were going to camp out in this camper. And I snuck in the house and got a bottle. They had like 5 bottles of cream de menthe, so I took one of those bottles of cream de menthe. I thought, they'll never miss this. Well, we took it out there, and we were all drinking this stuff. And it's thick. You got to swallow it, and it's terrible. But it got me where I wanted to go. But what I would do is go in the house in between times and take chugs out of the Jim Beam or the vodka, because by the time I get something in me, I'm not afraid of my dad anymore. And I got really drunk. And that night, I passed out in the upstairs in the top bunk of that camper and woke up in the morning, and my face was stuck to the mattress. I'm not kidding you. I pulled it up, and there was a green stain all the way around my face. Yeah. And I went in the house, and I washed my face off, of course. My mom and my friends were over, so she had made a big breakfast. So she had ham and bacon and eggs and toast. And my friends went home, and I went out to do chores. And I was out there scooping in the hog house, scooping manure in the hog house. And out came bacon and eggs and toast. And it was like green eggs and ham. It was like, oh, man. Yeah, it was a bad morning, a bad morning. But you didn't not go to work. You know, that was the way it was. I could go out drinking and get home late at night, but you went out and did chores in the morning. That's just the way it was. So I was out there working. So anyway, I started going, about that time we started going to this small town. I mentioned Templeton, and it was about 5 miles away. And we'd go there every Friday night. And I would go sneak away with the restaurant owner's son, and we'd get like 7, 8 beers. We'd shotgun beers. We'd do the beer bong thing, you know, and so I'd get it down real fast and get drunk. I go back up to this cafe and ride home. My parents shut my mouth, and nobody knew any wiser. They drink a beer or two at the restaurants. They didn't smell me. And I started to live for Friday night. I love Friday nights. Loved it. I've heard of people talking about hiding their bottle. Well, Friday night was my bottle. During the week, I knew Friday night was coming. So, you know, I mentioned the geek that I was in junior high in junior high. And so I got to high school the next year. Everybody remember, and everything changed in high school for me. Everything changed. Remember the kid in high school that was really popular? The guys all wanted to hang out with him. The girls wanted to date him. That was not me. I was the same geek I was in junior high. But what happened, the miracle happened, was I knew Friday nights were coming. So I was a kid. I mentioned a little kid. They call it bullying today. I got picked on quite a bit. I hated being in school. Now, I could read a book. I could take a test. And so I got good grades. But I just never fit in there. And we all talk about that, but I did not fit in. I was the geek. I really was. And I absolutely hated that. But again, Friday night was going to be there. I knew Friday night was coming. So during the week, I could do that. Started drinking as much as I could. Again, I was kind of limited. Turned 15, got a little older, got a school permit. Drank a lot driving that school permit. Anybody like to drink and drive? I loved drinking and driving. Loved it. Was not very good at it. I was not good at it. Not at all. I wrecked my first car at 16, parked into one of the bigger size transmission pole, electric transmission pole, power pole. Yeah, about killed my best friend. Jane talked about it on Friday, which, by the way, I should tell you guys, you know, you guys had the big hitters Friday and Saturday. No secret there at all. Flew Jane in from Florida, flew Sarah in last night from Philadelphia. This morning, you're kind of waking up with the low hitter that drove down from Ames, okay? Kind of waking up with that guy, so I apologize about that. But anyway, I started drinking as much as I could, and I turned 16. I was drinking at my school, but I turned 16, and shortly after that was when I had that accident. And it happened to anybody. What happened was we were drinking, and I was really drunk. My buddy was driving, and I said, hey, this is my so-and-so car. I'm driving my car. You know, you're not driving my car. And we were smoking Swisher Sweets, drinking vodka, Budweiser. I'm a Budweiser guy, Budweiser vodka. And I was driving, and it happened to anybody. I forgot that I was driving. I mean, it just happens, you know. And so I dropped my Swisher Sweet, and I was down under the steering wheel looking for my Swisher, and came up. We were in the ditch and hit this pole. I don't know, 70 miles an hour? Should have died. You know, I've had many friends since then that have died doing that. And Jane talked about her friend, you know, that died with doing that. Took out the windshield, walked away. my first thought was, got to hide the vodka. It was hard to get that vodka back then. I'd hide the vodka bottle. My car was a 75 Mercury Cougar. Anybody older here remembers the Cougar? It was a great car. 400 two-barrel. It was just a screamer. I just loved that car. But I walked to the nurse's house and knocked on the door. It was a deputy sheriff. I know. It was like, oh, my God, what are the chances? But the nice thing was, and I think it was a nice thing, he knew my dad. My dad was pretty well-known in the area. And he had me blow, and it was .27, which is, you know, respectable. I've heard a lot higher than that. Respectable. And what he said was, he said, your dad's going to take care of this. So he gave me a ticket for a failure to maintain control of a motor vehicle. No OWI. I've never gotten an OWI. Okay, I'll tell you that. And I obviously, you hear this a lot, I obviously should have. That night I should have gotten one for sure. But I went on, and I was, I love drinking. And I was not good. A lot of you guys have tried, they talked about the extracurricular stuff. I wasn't good at it. You know, we had a, and I didn't, it wasn't for lack of trying. I tried. You know, I was always drunk when I tried to smoke. Back then it was pot and smoke weed. And I my friend and I got a, I don't know, whatever that is. How much is this in a bag? Whatever that is. Got that much. Whatever it is. Okay, an eight. There we go. Thanks, Andrew. I knew you'd know. And we got back, and by then I had a 74 Monte Carlo. Big old swivel seats, the thick rug on the floor, thick shag carpet. I call it shag carpet, big thick carpet. And we got in there, and we squirted up a pop can. I didn't have a one-hitter. I didn't have any of that kind of stuff. You've done that before. And we were drunk. And so what happened was we squirted the sucker off, and somebody told us how to do it. I didn't know how to do it. Poked the holes in it, you know. And, you know, I bought it. And so he was going to do it first. I said, no way. I bought it. I'm doing it first. Well, what happened is, I was drunk, and he went to light it, and I went, I started laughing, and it went all over my damn car. We went through most of the bag that way, could not get anything in us. It was infuriating. So I tried a few times after that, and I kept complaining to my friends, hey, you know, I can never feel like I'm getting high. And so one night, we were kind of pre-partying, and my friend's blazer, back then it was just a blazer, now it was the K-blazer, the full-size blazer, and three friends with us. I didn't say friends. They were acquaintances. You'll hear why I say that pretty soon here. And the guy that was in the driver's seat, his name was Paul, he said, hey, tonight you're going to feel something. I guarantee you. This is good stuff. So my friends, they took it first. And they went, just a little, like that. And I thought, what in the heck? So I took three long, and they all got, their eyes got really big like this. And I didn't know what was going on. Well, I got to the party. And first, I mean, I'll get up on the chair. First, I was like this, looking down on everybody at the party. And then I was like underground, trying to walk. Yeah. And I went to my car. I thought, man, this is not right. I went to my car and got in my car, reclined the seats, and closed my eyes. And I was flying down an elevator shaft, falling down an elevator shaft. And I tell you, standing now, I still think I would have died. What happened is right before I hit the bottom, I was able to open my eyes and look to the side, and my heart was just racing. I found out later it was laced with LSD. I know, man. So it wasn't for lack of trying, but after that night, I didn't smoke any more weed. I knew what vodka would do. I knew what Budweiser would do, and I stuck with that stuff. I really did. So, you know, there's a lot of funny things that I did. One thing I showed recently at Pockets of Enthusiasm in Omaha, and poor Jane was there. I'm sorry, Jane. You're going to hear this again. I'm so sorry. But I came home one night very, very, very drunk, and I had fallen on my face. You know, we don't catch ourselves on gravel, and this whole side of my face was torn up. And I always had to check in with my parents when I got home. But that night, my parents were gone. They were with friends somewhere. I knew they were going to be gone. So I didn't worry about coming home drunk. Which, by the way, I didn't worry about that at all later on, but at that time I was still pretty scared about that because my dad was pretty tough. So I got home, and I went straight up to bed. They weren't home yet. Well, what I didn't know is I was dripping blood all the way up the stairs. So my parents get home, and they see this blood, and my dad comes up to wake me up. Now, my dad was in Vietnam. He was wounded in Vietnam. He was drill sergeant after that. He was a tough guy, like I said. And so he'd seen people die of alcohol poisoning in Vietnam. That was something that just happened. And he came up there and could not wake me up. And he shook me and shook me and shook me and finally got me up. And what he did that night is my dad's gone now, so this is kind of emotional for me. He marched me around the evergreens at our home farm, our home acreage, all night long. And I was in a blackout, so I was told this the next day. But he marched me because he was going to die of alcohol poisoning. Woke up in the morning on the couch, which I knew wasn't right. I was like, oh, man, this isn't good. And I could hear my dad breathing right next to me on the floor. He was trying to make sure I was breathing all night long, that I stayed breathing. So that was the kind of drunk I was. There's a lot of funny stories, a lot of fun stuff that I did, but that was the kind of stuff that I did, you know. So I'm not going to go, and I drank from 13 to just before I turned 18, a month before I turned 18. So I'm not going to give you a lot of drunk log, but that was the kind of drunk that I was. Totally self-centered, did not care what anybody else thought, drank, and that was my deal. We talk about that all the time, but I was just typical that way. So I, what happened was, you know, what I was like, what happened was, August 2nd of 86, I was out doing it one more time, and I put my car in the ditch, and I suppose it was years, I don't know, I'd wake up in the morning, there'd be grass hanging under my Monte Carlo, and I'd have to pop, back then you could pop the bumper back out with a sledgehammer if it got pushed in. I would do that, you know, if I hit something or hit the ditch, whatever it was. And that morning, the next morning, what I did that night is I took off a couple more of those poles, not the bigger ones this time, the smaller ones, but took off two of those with my car. Went through barbed wire fence. Remember the Monte Carlos with the Landau top, kind of the vinyl top? It was all torn off by the barbed wire. I mean, it was looking bad. And I got home and just went to bed like nothing happened. You know, say I'm home, you know, I went to bed. And the next morning, my dad got up and saw that car, and he came up there, and I did what I always did. I lied. I made up this big, convoluted lie that, hey, we're on a dirt road, and we slid off in the ditch. We fixed the fence last night and took care of the farmer. I'm just lying. And my dad, you know, my dad couldn't stand looking at me back then. And then he just walked out. He couldn't stand to be around me. He knew we had some physical altercations. I was not an abused kid, but we had physical altercations. My dad did not know what to do with me. So my parents drove to town that morning, and they drove past. It wasn't very far from home where I did this. They drove past where the poles were hanging off the wires. And they stopped in town on the way to our other farm, and my dad called me. And my dad, I'll never forget, this is exactly what he said. And my parents listened to my story one time, so they validated this. Exactly what he said was, here's the deal. You can leave. He called me at home. He goes, you can leave my home, and I don't ever want to see you again. And I was 17. I was a month from turning 18. Or you can call the sheriff. And Sheriff knew me on a first-name basis. I knew Sheriff Shaw pretty well. Call him, get him out to our house, we'll sit and talk to him, and you call the power company to get those poles fixed. Now, this was 86, and the poles back then, the little ones were $1,000. I can't imagine what they are today, but I always had money. I had my own money. I raised my own hogs and had money, so I paid for the poles. Sheriff came out, and what he asked me that morning is, I know right where we were standing at the home farm there. He said, Phil, do you think you have a problem with drinking? And what I said was, again, I was 17. I didn't think it could be drinking. You know, first of all, that was the stuff that was my deal, was drinking. That's all I really had going on back then. And I said, I don't know if it's that, but I know there's something wrong with me. I said, I know there's something wrong with me. And the miracle of being something wrong with me is that if it's me, I can change my actions. If it's Jordan, he's probably never going to change. Just kidding. But anybody out me is probably, I can't depend on them to change. I got to change. And that was a miracle of that. Now, what happened was my dad, this is the farming crisis. Anybody farmers have been around farmers at all? This is the mid-80s, the farming crisis. So my parents had all kinds of stress on them already, and here their oldest son was running amok. I had a younger brother and sister. I was out running amok. And so my dad had taken a job at the post office to keep the farm together, and I was managing the farm for him and a couple guys working for me. And so he had good insurance. He had Federal Blue Cross and Blue Shield. So he took me up to Sioux City to get an evaluation done. And I'd been to doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists, and I'd taken the test instead of having to pay for a fine, and took in the MMPI, what's that big one called? Yeah. And they all came back, well, this is peer pressure. You know, Phil's experiencing peer pressure. Well, I was the peer that was pressuring. I wasn't being pressured. But that morning, I went up there and did that, and the gal said, hey, you need to go to treatment. And I lied like I always did. My mom had this full notebook sheet of paper of all the things that happened when I was drinking. And the gal said, are these things true? I said, yeah, but I wanted to explain, you know. She said, no, you're going to treatment. So I went to treatment, and the thing that happened, I had a series of spiritual experiences is what I had. And that morning talking to the sheriff was the first one. It was my fault. That was a spiritual experience. It was never my fault. The next one that happened was at 7 days not drinking, and it certainly wasn't sobriety. I had to stay clean for 10 days before I went to treatment. Everybody had experienced that before. You got it. You can't get a bed right away. And so I was 7 days into it. I was up in the hog house working. I had these two guys working for me. One was my brother, and we did not get along. None of us got along, and I was coming apart at the seams. I was having a terrible day. And so I left the hog house to walk down the hill to our house. Parents were gone. I knew that they had Jim Beam under there, and they had vodka too, but they had Jim Beam and vodka. And I was going to take three long pulls on one of those bottles and get that feeling I talked about. And then go back and go to work, okay? And I got halfway down the hill, and again, spiritual experience, God, grace of God, I turned halfway down and ended up in the middle of my home cornfield, coming apart, crying, knew that I was going to drink, knew that I couldn't drink if I ever wanted to get anywhere in life. I knew what it was doing to me. And I got on my knees, and I said the first honest prayer, and Ashley talked about this, you know, all those years ago, and I was Catholic, nothing to do with the Catholic Church, but all those years of going to church, I said all the right prayers and did all the things, Hail Marys and Our Fathers. Never was it in here. It was always out there. God was in that building, okay? And that morning, I got on my knees and said, I just said, God help me. Andrew talks about that same thing. God help me. And I meant it. I was coming apart. And I got up, went back to work, and did not drink that day. I have not drank since that day. So I got to believe that that was a huge thing with my sobriety. I got to believe that that was. I think it was the thing with my sobriety, welcoming God in and continuing that relationship. Went through treatment, got out of treatment. They called me Father Phil in treatment. I was the youngest one, but I tried to help everybody else. You know, I thought I really had it going on. I could read a book and stuff, you know. It was crazy. I got out, and the third big spiritual experience happened. I got home that night. We didn't have cell phones. This was 86. And I got home that night, and I walked in, and it wasn't 5 minutes later, the phone was ringing. And I'm like, who in the heck even knows, I should tell you, Mom answered the phone, and she said, Phil, it's for you. And that's when I thought, who even knows I'm home? I just walked in the door, you know, and I got on the phone. This is for the second time I always get this. This guy named Lynn said, Phil, my name is Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to meet of age tonight. Would you like to go with me? Now, if Lynn had said anything else, I used to go to these meetings. I know where they are. Not going tonight, but hey, can you just drive to that meeting? Wouldn't have happened. I mean, I hadn't seen my girlfriend in 28 days, hadn't seen the few friends, I didn't have many friends, hadn't seen those guys in 28 days. So I was going to be the guy that got out and had a good time that night, and then the next day I was going to find that stuff they talked about in treatment. I was going to be that guy. And we all know the next day never comes. You know, it never would have come. And so he saved my life. And so I went to a meeting that night. Love to tell you that I jumped in AA, and man, this is great, you know. I was youngest by about 10 years of anybody staying sober in that meeting. It was a little farm town close to where I live. But I heard something. It was enough that I wanted to keep going. But what I did not, I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't start taking the steps. You could call that my home group. I didn't call that. I didn't know what, I just went there. Sometimes I'd go to 2 meetings a week if I was really splurging, you know. And I had an excuse. I was working a lot of hours on the farm. I was working 15-hour days, but there was plenty of time to go to meetings. I just didn't do that. And after about over a year, I had to stay home. I had academic scholarships for Iowa State to come out to go to school. And after a year of doing that, I had scheduled to go to school. And because I had to stay home the first year, I got out of treatment too late to go, blah, 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 it doesn't matter. So I got home, or I got to school, and the first night I was out in Ames, I thought, you know what, I'm going to go out tonight. I wasn't going to drink, absolutely not going to drink. I knew I wouldn't drink. But I was going to go to this party with a friend of mine and have a good time, and I wanted to meet people, especially girls. And I got there, and I sat sitting at the table drinking my Pepsi. I drank a lot of Pepsi back then. I'm looking at this girl across the room trying to make eye contact, you know, like we do. And I reached down for my Pepsi, and somebody had swapped it out, and it was Budweiser, which I already said was my beer. And I took it to my lips, and I remember a taste of it. And I went, and I don't know where it went. I don't have any idea where it went, but I spit it out, ran out in the hall. There was a water fountain right outside, and I rinsed my mouth out with water. And I was absolutely shaken. And my first thought was, go back in there. Nobody even knows you're doing this stuff. You know, I knew if I drank, I was going to meet the right, you know, meet a gal, and I was going to have a great time, and everything was going to be good, and I'd have all these friends. And again, the grace of God, another spiritual experience, I left. Didn't go back in there. The next night, I was in a meeting on Lincoln Way in Ames called Big Book Recovery Group. Those who've been sober, I don't know if anybody in here would have been to Big Book. But it was me, yeah, John was there, yeah. So I walked into this meeting, another spiritual experience. I walked in there, and there was kids younger than me who were sober longer than me, and there was smiles, and God, it was, you know, you had to sit down to see the smiles because the smoke was about right here. You know, back then, we still smoked in meetings. But I sat down and looked around the room, and I could see there was something with these people. It was in their eyes. And you know what I'm talking about. If somebody's doing it, it's in their eyes. It's God. I didn't know what it was then, but it's God. And I saw that, and I tell you what, I wanted that as much as I wanted that drink that night. The way that feeling hit me. I wanted what they had. And I started doing what they were doing. And I got a sponsor, started taking the steps. Got a home group. I got a job in that home group. Got a job outside my home group. All the things I still do today. I started doing those things. And slowly, and this is the thing, if you're newer, I'm not going to ask for hands. If you're newer here, AA is not like vodka. You can't go to 3 or 4 meetings and exhale and everything's better. You got to do some work. So that first year of I don't know, I'll call it sobriety. The first year when I went to meetings, I was never in AA. If I had drank the morning after I had that if I went to that party, and you'd ask me the next morning about AA, I would say, yeah, man, it doesn't work for me. I did it for a year. I didn't do it at all. You know, if you're sitting here and you're going to meetings and stuff is not getting better, get a sponsor. Take the steps. Get a home group. Get a job. Get a job outside your home group. District. District 7 is very active. Intergroup is very active in this town. Get a job and start giving back a little bit. So I did those things. Started feeling better. Slowly. So I had a sponsor named Denny. I'm going to make sure. When did I start? 35 left? Oh, God. Well, yeah, I won't go that long. You guys got lives. You want to get the heck out of here. So I started going to these meetings. I got this sponsor named Denny. And John knew Denny. Andrew knew Denny. Great guy. I think you did, Andrew. Great guy. But I would call Denny, and I was crazy. Okay, I was crazy. My friend Judy. A lot of you guys know Judy. She just got a 41-year chip in Ames. She tells a story that when I got to Ames, they talked to each other, and they said, there's no way this guy's going to make it. There's no way he's going to make it. And I was 13 months sober, thank you very much. Thought I had it going on. Absolutely crazy. So I got this Denny for a sponsor, and I would call Denny, and he would say, okay, what's going on? I mean, I'm sorry, but that's how I was. I'm so sorry. But I would throw this stuff. You guys are all loud. I mean, I can be loud. So I would lay all this stuff out for him, and he would be dead silent on the phone, wouldn't say a word. And he'd say, let me call Doug, and I'll call you back. So he'd call me back, and he'd say, well, we think you should do this. So finally I said, Danny, you think I should just get Doug? And a lot of you guys knew Doug. Doug Shirley, he's gone now. Had a big beard and great man. All love. And so I started calling Doug. And Doug saved my life in a lot of ways. But two things that Doug told me saved my life. One of them was I called him. I was hugely egotistical back then. Hugely egotistical. Way worse than now, believe it or not. Some of these. By the way, these are my sponsees in this third row back here. Thanks for coming down with me, you guys. I appreciate it. Not Andrew. I don't want to claim Andrew, but the rest of you guys are sponsees. So anyway, I would call Doug, and I said, I remember one time especially calling him, I said, you know what I was thinking of? Doug, when I'm 37, I'm going to have 20-year sobriety. And he goes, no, you won't. I said, do you think I'm going to drink? He goes, oh, probably not. Do you think I'm going to kill myself? Probably not. Somebody's probably going to kill you. You're freaking crazy, you know? And I was rubbing people wrong. I mean, I was nuts. The other thing Doug did for me, it was a miracle. Same kind of along the same line. I mentioned it was hugely important for me to be liked. It really was, because I just did not experience that. I mean, when I got sober, it was easier for me to get sober. I didn't have many friends out there wanting me to go back out drinking. That's just where I was at. That was my experience. So I called Doug, and I say, Doug, man, I really want people to think well of me here in AA and Ames, and I'm just concerned they're thinking poorly of me. I'm really concerned about that. He goes, I got really good news. I said, they do like me? He goes, no, they don't think about you at all. And thank God for that. You know, Sandy Beach, who's gone now, he spoke a lot around here, traveling on speaking. He used to talk about his goal was to be small enough to walk through a keyhole. Walk through a keyhole. You know, the smaller I am, the bigger God is. And so my goal today is to be as small as possible. I am not significant. When I start thinking I'm significant, I'm in trouble. So started doing this deal, took the steps, met a gal. I was at a party for a friend of mine's sobriety party, and I actually met her son first, Sean. And Sean was 2 years old, and I love kids. I've always loved it. I got five grandkids and one on the way, and I love kids. But I was playing with Sean, and we were throwing rocks up in the air and let them land on our heads and just giggling, having a great time. You know, and people were walking by and say, you found some of your own age group to play with. That's nice, you know. Well, the next week, that was a Saturday. The next Monday, I called Lisa, was her name. And I said, hey, I really want to take Sean. I'm a bass fisherman. I've got a couple ponds out in southern Iowa and some timber and some land down there. And it's our favorite place to go. But all my life, I've been a bass fisherman. And I said, I'd like to take Sean out fishing. And I knew what she'd say. She said, well, I don't know you well enough. I'd have to go with you. I'm like, that's fine. You know? I kind of like this gal, too. I liked Sean's mom, too. And we went out, and we started dating, and we dated for a year, and we were engaged for a year, and we got married. Now, I really thought I was doing everything right, okay? But my thought was, we already had Sean, so we should have a little girl as soon as possible. So we have a boy and a girl, and, you know, live happily ever after. Everything's fine. So we took this honeymoon to the Grand Canyon. And got down there and didn't get along very well down there, but we must have gone fairly well because we came back pregnant with twins. Yeah. My mind kind of snapped. I'll tell you what, my mind kind of snapped. You went in and got the ultrasound, and I was like, oh my God, we're having twins. And I was 22 years old. And when I turned 23, I had three kids. And again, I'll tell you, my mind in some ways literally snapped. I got some outside help. I'll just tell you that. I don't know if I share that, but I did. And I was totally, totally freaked out. I was petrified. And I was going to 4, 5, 6 meetings a week, and I had the service position. I said I was doing. Well, I made a conscious decision, man, I've got a family. I've got to work more. I've got to cut back on that AA stuff. So I cut back to, I don't think I went to less than 3. I probably did a few times, maybe 2, but I still went to meetings, but that's it. Stopped talking to my sponsor, stopped talking to Doug, and worked a lot. I had 3 jobs. I was raising hogs. That's what I knew. I was raising hogs 20 miles north of Ames, a little town called Ellsworth outside of that town. I was working at UPS. I was a preload supervisor for UPS. And before I'd go to UPS at 3 in the morning, I would go mop the floors at Hickory Restaurant, which most of you from Ames or from New Way have heard of that. And I'd go there, and it was back. It's not the current one. It was actually on South 16th at the time. And I'd mop those floors. I'd put on my tie and go supervise the preload of these UPS cars. And then I would go home and work hogs all day. So I was getting about 3 hours sleep a night. You know, yeah, about like James last night. or Jackson, probably. And I was crazy, absolutely bounced off the walls crazy. And I was not, it's embarrassing. I was 5 years sober, 6 years sober, and I was a terrible husband. I was a terrible father. Joe and I have talked about that. I was absolutely intense. I was coming apart. And I remember driving down to I was still wrecking cars while in sobriety. I was crazy, okay? I would not pay attention where I was going, and I'd wreck a car. I had speed. If you bring up my Iowa Courts Online, everybody ever done that? Look somebody up on Iowa Courts Online. My sheet's this long, all in sobriety. All from sobriety. Speeding tickets. Almost all of it was speeding tickets. But anyways, driving on to UPS one morning, early in the morning, and I remember consciously thinking to myself, you know what? You're not a good husband. You're not a good A member anymore. You're not a good dad. You just as well keep going south. And I hear people talk about one that commits suicide. That would have been my suicide. No way I would have stayed sober. No way I would have probably, most likely wouldn't have lived through that. That's just where I was at. And I turned the wheel, went to work, and talked to my sponsor, Doug, and I said, hey, you know, I was not being sponsored by that man. And it wasn't anything to do with Doug. Doug was a wonderful man. But I was not calling him. I was not being honest with him. And he and I made a mutual decision I needed to change. And I called my current sponsor, who is the same name as mine, which is very helpful. I don't forget his name, Phil. So I called Phil, and Phil, most of you guys know Phil. Phil C., he lived down here in Des Moines for quite a while, and now he's up in Ogden. I get to see him in at least 2 meetings a week I get to see him, which is really nice. I'm still an eyeball guy. I still like to see my sponsor. I'm still that way today. Called him, and I called him, and what he said was, hey, we're going to get back in the Center of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's simple. And we all know it's simple. It's not complicated. But you can't read about it. You can't think about it. You can't talk about it. You got to freaking do it. And I wasn't doing it. I could still say pretty things in meetings, but I wasn't doing it. So I did that. Now, something I share with you, my dad and I did not have a good relationship until 7 years in, when I was 7 years sober. And my dad called Phil, looked him up in the phone book. We didn't have cell phones yet. And called my sponsor at home and said, my name is Tom. I'm Phil's dad. That AA stuff ain't doing for him. And I just want to let you know, I think it's a bunch of crap. And Phil listened to this guy. He was ranting to Phil. And Phil said, hey, give me 6 months, Tom. Give me 6 months. Let me work with Phil for 6 months. And my dad was obviously from then on eternally grateful because I got back in the center of AA. Okay. Thank God for that. So, again, I'm not going to talk. I don't want to talk too darn long here.
You're doing great.
Thank you, Ryan. You're the only one that would say that. Thank you. So I got back in AA, and I mentioned, I haven't mentioned this, but Eldora is near and dear to my heart. Anybody ever go through Eldora in here? Sometimes I have that. Okay. No, not visiting, but actually in Eldora. Okay. Awesome. Joe, yeah, Joe, you were there. Heck yeah. And somebody else over here? James, you were there? Okay. So I started going to Eldora in 1987, and I love going to Eldora. Okay. We started taking meetings in there back then. They're always Thursday evening at 7. And for quite a while, we were told not to come during COVID, you know, and we were, obviously that was the way it was. Something happened. We went there for a while, and something happened, and they asked us not to come back for a while. It wasn't us, but it was something else that happened in the street, I call it a jail, whatever, a prison. By the way, Eldora is like a young people's jail, a prison in Iowa is what it is. It's you know, there's murders in there. There's attempted murder, there's burglary, there's they're tough kids. You know, they're tough kids. And so I was up there this last Thursday. I was just up there. And they let us back in. And now what we do is we go up Thursday morning. My sponsor, myself, and a dear friend named Glenn, who a lot of you guys know Glenn. We go up there on Thursday mornings, and we sit through two of their treatment classes. And it's like a panel workshop. We share about ourselves, and we get the kids sharing about themselves. And it took a while, but we've developed a rapport. They trust us a little bit, so they're sharing things about themselves. And I always go around the room, and I say, you know, let's go around and introduce yourselves, and whatever you think you are, share that too. And so, Phil's poor alcoholic, Glenn, our alcoholic. And it got to the second kid around, and a lot of these kids they're in there for drug-related or alcohol offenses, okay? That's why they're there. But a lot of them do not believe they have a problem, and I absolutely respect that. Totally understand. You know, we're really planting the seed, mostly is what we do. Second kid in, though, he goes, I said, you know, his name, I don't remember, doesn't matter what his name was. He said his name, and he said, I'm addicted to fun. I'm like, welcome, you know? Aren't we all? You know, it's like, oh, here's your membership card, you know? Come on in. But of course, he thought he was being sarcastic, but really, I totally understand that. But what I want to share about with that is the last person in line, last kid in line, said, I'm pretty sure I'm alcoholic. And I said, what makes you feel that way? The last night that he drank, woke up the next morning out of a total blackout, and his friend said, he said, what happened last night? His friend goes, you don't remember anything? No, I don't. His friend showed him a video, and I don't know who took the video or how this came about, but there was a video of him beating another kid in the back of the head with a stick like this big. And the kid said, the guy's still in a coma in the hospital. And depending if he lives or dies, I'm going to find out where I'm going to go when I get out of Eldora. And chances are, who knows? I mean, if he dies, he's going to be gone for a long, long time. And I share that because he said, I'm not that way. Aren't we all? We're not that way. We put whatever it is into our system, and we become that way, whatever that way is. That is alcoholism. That's drug addiction. I don't care what you call it. And the last kid I'll talk about, and again, I love being there. And I always give him here's what I tell him. I give him my card with my phone number, my cell phone on it, and I tell him, give me a call on the way home. They get THVs, temporary home visits. And they get discharged, of course. I said, on the way home, give me a phone call. Or now I say, shoot me a text. Nobody likes calling. I mean, young kids like calling. Nobody likes calling anymore. I like calling. But I give them my text, shoot me a text. So a kid named Christian, who's been serious. I could tell it. I could see it on him. He really feels like he's done. He came up after me and he said, hey, I lost your card. Can I have it again? I got a THV this weekend. So on Friday afternoon, Christian shoots me a text. Hey, this is Christian. I'm on the way home. And I tell these kids, if I don't know somebody in your hometown that's active in AA, I will drive to your hometown and go to a meeting with you. I've done it five, six, seven times. I don't know how often. But I knew somebody. He's going to Old Wine. I know somebody in Waterloo. In fact, he was very active at Area. Lance is his name, dear friend of mine. And I said, Christian, I'm going to shoot you a contact. I didn't have Christian's number until then, of course, his cell phone number. I'm going to shoot you a contact. You call this guy. So Christian... Not 3 minutes later, hey, I shot him a text. I said, no, call the guy. And so he called the guy, and I get a call from my buddy Lance, I don't know, 2 hours later. And he said, man, thanks for turning Christian off to me. We're going, I said, well, is there meetings in Old Wine? No, there's not, but I'm going to pick him up in Old Wine and bring him to Waterloo tonight. And Lance was all excited. And I don't know where it's going to go from there, but damn, that's a big deal. Damn, that's a big deal. And again, I get to stay sober. I've been doing, like I said, 37 years I've been doing this, and I've been able to stay sober. But if you got a kid like that that is actually serious and actually makes the phone call, man, that's a big deal. So anyway, that was that. You know, I how much more time do I get? So I've got five grandkids, like I said. Again, I don't want to talk too long. I got five grandkids, like I said, and my oldest granddaughter just turned 8. Her name is Ruby, and Ruby is a gem. Oh my gosh, Ruby's the best. She's just a wildcat, okay? And Ruby is addicted to sugar. Jordan knows Ruby a little bit. Ruby's addicted to sugar. So the second last day of school, she's getting out of second grade. I mentioned graduating. These kids nowadays graduate from grade school. It's just crazy. But she's getting out, and so I go to her grade school and pick her up, and I say, hey, let's go out. What do you want to do? And she goes, I want to go for ice cream. sounds good. So we're driving to Dairy Queen, and she goes, Papa, I need to tell you something. I said, what's that? She goes, lately ice cream has been giving me a pretty bad stomach ache, and sometimes I throw up. I mean, it gives me a bad stomach ache. And I said, well, let's go to the cafe, a nice restaurant up there, and get some carrot cake or something. You like their carrot cake? And she goes, Grandpa, I'll accept the consequences. Please, save a chair for that girl. I mean, she's just dynamite. She's just, I mean, straight face. I will accept the consequences. Just love her. Just love her. So I'm going to share the last part of this. I'm going to share one more thing about basic story, and then I want to talk about God for a little while. My wife and I, this last January, I go to Africa, and we go down there trying to help a little bit. We go down there, mostly I have a lot of friends down there. We go to Uganda, and we were down there this January, and I've been down there, this is my seventh trip down, my wife's second trip down, and we were down there, and they came to me, and they know what I am. People, where I go, people tend to know who I am and what I am. I don't make a big secret of that. And they came to me and said, Phil, we got a guy, and these guys, this is the grass roof, wood, mud huts what they live in, okay? We got a guy out in the bush, they call it, about a mile and a half from the care point. They have, we have three care points we support down there. They're basic orphanages. Give them a safe place to be, give them a free meal a day, pay for school, they got to pay to move up in grades, we pay for that, and we give them health care. And they're joyous. It's a simple joy down there. God, I just love it down there. So they came to me and said, hey, we got this guy, and he's really drinking a lot, and he's really tearing up his family, and it's horrible. Would you go talk to him? Of course I'll go talk to him. So we're walking. We had to walk out there. It's a long walk, and I'm walking along, and this guy next to me, the big guy, he goes, hey, I got great news. I've been sober 15 years. So that's awesome. So I had, 30 years at the time. So we get there, and this guy, we get there, and his, you've all seen it. His wife is crying. His kids are just dirty, and they just look terrible. They call it the compound, so there's different huts. The kids have a hut. The mother and father have a hut. They have a hut for cooking. They have a hut for storing wood. And the whole place is a disaster. The roofs are terrible. And he comes stumbling out of the maize field. They call it maize down there, which is significant. Like I said, that was the first time I really talked to God in a cornfield. And this guy is with me. He goes, hey, Julius is the guy's name. Julius is his name. And he said, Julius, let's go out behind one of your huts. They're round, so kind of behind is just the other side of the hut, Anyway, we went back there, and we got on our knees. And the official language in Uganda is English. But a lot of them, especially the older ones, don't speak English. They speak what's called a tesel. And I know basic, hello, how are you, that kind of stuff. Yoga, yoganoi. I know the basic stuff. But we got on our knees, and we said a prayer. And I didn't know the words, but I knew the prayer. It was language of the heart. This guy was saying the prayer that we say. God, please help Julius. Please help Julius to get to find out what he needs to find out and whatever, the things that we say. And we got up off our knees. And I heard a little bit about Julius about a year later. They sent out a newsletter, and Julius' name came up, that Julius was doing this, and he was doing well. Okay, and I thought, man, that's so great. Didn't hear anything for another 3 years, and I was down there this last year. And I asked about Julius. And they said, well, you want to go out and see Julius? I said, yeah, I want to go out and see Julius. We go over 2 years, and it didn't work out 2 years ago, but this year it worked out. And I get out there. The place was immaculate. Kids were smiling. Wife was happy. And there was just joy in the air. And Julius had not taken a drink in 4 years since that prayer. I left a big book down there, and the kids read the big book to him. He doesn't read English, but the kids read English. And man, how do you top that? And we left, and we were there for 10 days, and we went to the Serengeti. If you haven't seen the Serengeti, it's fabulous. We had a wonderful time in the Serengeti and saw just all kinds of fabulous stuff. Nothing touched my time with Julius. High point of my trip. Absolute high point. So, again, I'm going to talk. And Ashley mentioned, I have a relationship with God. For years, I would do that. I drive a lot. There was years I was driving 60,000 miles a year for my job. I drive around and shoot the crap for a living with farmers. And those are things I can do. Drive and shoot the crap. That's all I have going for me. So I would drive around and I would listen and I would shut the radio off and just talk to God. Just talk to God. I have absolutely nothing against whatever your conception is. I don't go to church today. Okay. I go to a lot of churches, but not on Sunday morning and Saturday night. That's just me. Okay. But I talk to God a lot. And I drive around and I do that. Well, not long ago, Andrew and I were talking about this. The 12th step, or 11th step, it says, sought through prayer and meditation. And I was not meditating. And if you ask me, I'd tell you, I'm just not good at it. Not good at it. Well, there's no such thing about being good at meditation. You do it or you don't do it. And I started doing that. At the beginning of the year, I set a goal for myself, 5 minutes a day, which for a guy like me, 5 minutes is a long time. But I soon found out that my mind didn't even start to shut off in 5 minutes. No way. And so I upped it, and now I'm at 25 minutes. And I got up early enough this morning. I got up at 5:30 this morning and did. I do a morning routine. I do a workout in the morning, then I come up and I read my books, and I eat, and I get on the elliptical for 10 minutes. I do this 25-minute meditation. And it's enabled me to slow down. It, for years, I have had an intensity problem. Any of you who knows me knows this. Jordan doesn't very well. An intensity problem where I am very quick to react, and not in good ways. And my friend Glenn and I talk about spiritual space. My spiritual space has been very, very difficult to hold on to. Spiritual space is that gap between you think and what you say or do. And mine is, and I'm talking years, okay? I'm talking like maybe a few years ago. It's gotten better after, you know, a few years ago, but it's still been a difficult thing. My spiritual space is so much better. I'm not telling anybody here what to do, but since I started doing that, just sitting and being still. And again, I got to bring myself back to, I breathe. You talk about your breathing, you know. And I thought this stuff was weird. Don't get me wrong, but I love it now. And bring myself back to my breathing many, many times while I'm sitting there doing that for 25 minutes. But I do that, and I get up off my knee, I sit down and I do that. Get up, and I go about my business, and for some reason, I'm not that crazy reactionary guy that I used to be. Not perfect. But I'm not techie, so I still have my issues with computers sometimes. They don't work right. It irks me, but not like it used. Not like it used. But I get frustrated. Very seldom I had a swearing problem. I had what's called swearing Tourette's. My wife and I have a bunch of rental houses, and I'd be working on a project, and if it went right the first time or even the second time, I was okay. But the third time, there's swearing Tourette's. All those swear words coming out, swearing Tourette's, and I got in trouble for this with my wife. Okay, I don't mean that disrespect for somebody who has that, but that's what I called it. I apologize. Okay, I don't want to offend anybody. But that's gotten a lot better. So you know, that's kind of where I'm at today. You know, I still have a long, long way to go. The book says the best years of our existence lie ahead, and I absolutely believe that. And I'm standing here August 2nd. If I make it to August 2nd, I'll have 38 years sober. I have this much. I really do. Now, real quick, I apologize. I'm embarrassed. I am married to a woman today. Same name as my first wife, Lisa. Again, smarter than I look. So I never call her the wrong name. But we met on the job. She's very involved with trails, Rails to Trails projects. The High Trestle Trail was one of her projects. That's what she does. So we had a trail project going on. I buy land for construction projects. I didn't tell that. I buy land for construction projects. And we had this trail project going on. They called her in as an expert to help us out. And we met, and we hit it off. We started dating, and we've been married now for 10 years. And my ex and I are good friends. We got divorced after 16 years of marriage. And I did a lot of damage, like I said, that first 5-6 years. And we just, part of it was that, and part of it, we just weren't good partners. The wife I have today, we are good partners. I adore that lady. Absolutely adore that lady. And we were good business partners. We're good in our marriage, we're good partners. And we have a lot of fun. And I mentioned that kid saying he's addicted to fun. I like to have a good time, okay? I liked it when I was out there. I liked it when I'm in here. And we talk about this. If there's no joy or fun in our existence, it says in the book, what newcomer wants it? We got to have fun. So I like to have a good time. I'm going to close. I talked longer than I planned to talk, actually, as a matter of fact. And so is everybody still awake? God, that's amazing. That is amazing. I'm going to share this. You guys always share the responsibility statement, which I absolutely love, by the way. Thank you. I'm going to share this reading. And you guys have heard. This is Dr. Bob's farewell talk. Anybody heard of that before? Okay. Dr. Bob's farewell talk. And this is from July 30th, 1950, the first International AA Convention. So it's the 15th year of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob gets up. By the way, Dr. Bob died 4 months later, okay? And he gives this farewell talk, is what we call it. I'm going to read it. I'm not going to read all of it. I'm going to read quite a bit of it, though. It's not very long, so bear with me. My good friends in AA and of AA, I get a big thrill out of looking out over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing. He's talking about doing a small thing. You know, it's like, here I am, a schmuck. some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. Sorry, I got to read slow. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all do the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. There are two or three things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to pay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with the Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, not mine, by the way, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's keep those two things in mind. Let us also remember, this was for me, let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. Kindness, consideration, tolerance. We see that in the big book. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time, Lynn, took me to my first meeting, if somebody had, and Doug, and my current sponsor, Phil, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to do numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf, so let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend to our less fortunate brothers that help which is so, I'm going to say it again. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend to our less fortunate brothers that help which has been so beneficial to us. And he says, thank you very much. Thank you very much.